Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I'm Eric Bradner, State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, and today we're talking about end-of-life issues. Our guests are State Representative Tim Brown, a medical doctor and Republican from Crawfordsville who chairs the House Ways and Means Committee, as well as Dr. Susan Hickman, a psychologist with the IU School of Nursing, and Dr. Jerry Walthall with Franciscan St. Francis Health. And one of the topics we're going to talk about is the POST program. It's a new law that takes effect on July 1st and sort of tries to help people think through some of these end-of-life decisions. And Dr. Brown, you authored the bill that created this program. I wondered if you could sort of explain to people what this is and why it matters and how you got involved with it.
Well, thank you, Eric, and pleasure to be here. The POST, or Physician Ordered for Sustaining Treatment, had to do with end-of-life decisions so that the patient could be more vocal, more active in their care at the end. As a physician and with Dr. Walthall, hearing what he was dealing with, have seen where when you went from home to hospital to a nursing home to a hospice setting to assisted living, that there were forms that were different on what you wanted to have happen to you. All sorts of intravenous therapy or not. So to make some consistency across all those state licensed entities, thought it would be best to have a common type of outline that the patient could sign and declare.
Sure. And Susan, this is something you've been working on for quite some time now. I understand you've been involved in education and research related to these issues for many years. Can you talk about the significance of Indiana taking this step, how Indiana sort of fits into the national scene, and what this could mean moving forward?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you also for the opportunity, Eric. I'm glad to be here today. The POST program is based on a model that was first developed approximately 20 years ago, and it really evolved out of concerns about the problem that Dr. Brown just described, that there are situations where people have described and explained their preferences, like in the nursing facility setting, and then something in the middle of the night happens, that resident is rushed to the hospital and receives treatments that they may have previously indicated they really did not want. And this was really an all too common problem in a lot of settings, because the preferences that that person has expressed in the nursing facility don't always travel with them across settings. And there are both practical and legal barriers to that occurring, so that people's preferences aren't communicated. Healthcare providers don't have the information they need to honor preferences. So this problem was first identified, and the POST model was identified as a solution about 20 years ago in Oregon. And over the years, numerous states have adopted this model and have created their own versions. Those states include West Virginia. We see use in New York, Pennsylvania, California, Washington. It's right now at about 16 states. Iowa recently passed legislation, and then, of course, Indiana just passed legislation. It's really a part of a national movement to try and provide some standardization of preferences, and in a format that can transfer across settings. The most important piece of information that you need to know about the POST is it is a medical order, and that actually gives it the power that it needs to make a difference in the kinds of treatments and care that people receive.
And Dr. Walthall, can you talk from a physician's perspective on why this matters, why this information is useful to have thought through beforehand and to have available when you're making these end-of-life decisions?
Yes, Eric, and again, I thank you for having us here today. I think it's a very important discussion. As a clinician, I practiced head and neck surgery and did a lot of cancer surgery all over the years. And sadly, despite all the marvelous things we've developed in medicine these days, we still reach circumstances where we have things we can no longer cure or restore. And therefore, we have to have difficult discussions with folks about how we manage things, given choices they have before them. And as a practitioner, I witnessed that quite often folks would come into the hospital essentially having dialed 911 and showing up in the emergency room with no prior consideration about what they were bargaining for or would want to consider, and sadly many times unable to express their own wishes. And then the family, who had had no input about that, would be very conflicted about whether they should or shouldn't do certain things. And so by default, folks would get a lot of interventions that may or may not have been in keeping with who they were. And as physicians, we were not able to understand what that goal should be. And so by default, you would tend to do more rather than less just because you didn't know. And you would wonder going forward whether that was the right answer or not for folks.
We're talking about end-of-life issues today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, connecting on Facebook or Twitter at No Limits, or calling 866-476-3881. And Dr. Hickman, you were talking about other states that have taken this up and that this is something that's built some momentum over about 20 years. Can you talk a little bit about the impact it's had in other states? Is there any way to quantify that, or is there anecdotal evidence? Are these states happy with the decisions they've made to sort of go down this road with the POST program?
I know the clinicians in those states are by and large enormously relieved. Clinicians really want to do the right thing. They want to honor people's preferences, and unfortunately, the tools that we've had previously are very limited in several key ways, and they make it challenging for healthcare providers to actually honor a patient's preferences. Many people are familiar with the living will, and one of the big challenges with the living will is that it requires the interpretation of a physician and documentation as orders before it can be acted upon. So people like emergency medical services personnel are not authorized to act on that living will. They can't honor that in the field. So if you have somebody who's living in the home, they're on hospice, and something happens and the family panics and calls 911, even though everyone knows that that person had opted for a focus on comfort and did not want to go to the hospital, EMS really has their hands tied in terms of what they can and can't do in that situation, and are often required to transport people to a hospital setting, which may not have been at all what that person wanted. So this tool actually allows healthcare providers to honor preferences. So there have been numerous studies that have looked at that, and I've actually personally been the principal investigator on several of those, looking at the use in the hospice setting, looking at the use with emergency medical personnel, and then also in the nursing facility setting. And the research, by and large, suggests that POST actually does make a difference in the kinds of treatments people receive. People receive treatments that are consistent with their preferences, and that healthcare providers find it to be a really valuable tool in understanding what people want and how to best provide that care.
Representative Brown, when you talk about end-of-life issues, this is something that's become, to some extent, politically charged, from Terry Schiavo quite some time ago to the talk about death panels during the healthcare reform debate. You were successful in getting this through the legislature this year, but is it sticky to raise these issues? What kind of reception did you get, especially because I think you're the only medical doctor in the House, at least, right?
At this time, I'm the only medical doctor. There were three at one time, but I guess I've sustained by stamina or something there. That was one of the things we talked about that potentially would be a pitfall coming in. And I think it was just the presentation and the excellent job of the coalition and excellent job of Dr. Hickman and Dr. Walthall to lay the groundwork. You know, we were having these decisions already made. We were having what are called do not resuscitate forms done in hospitals and nursing homes, and everybody understood that. And so we painted it as we are not changing that at all. It's a patient's wish. It's a patient's wish. And so then you don't get into, well, is somebody else deciding for you? Because I know in the first year we brought it up, it was a lot of discussion about, okay, if the patient is unable to speak, who becomes the next person that becomes responsible for that? So, again, focusing on the patient, I think, made us stay away from those issues.
And Dr. Walthall, how far down the road is Indiana at this point? Obviously, the law takes effect on July 1st, but there are forms to develop. There's implementation that needs to take place. How long do you expect this to take? What has Indiana done or what is already done at this point? What else needs to be done to make this work?
Well, our coalition is aware that, to some degree, our work is just beginning. It's been arduous for 3 years, but we've got a long way to go. The form technically is not available for public use as yet. It's in the hands of the State Department of Health, and they will own the form and have it up on their website when they complete that. Our expectation is that that will be quite soon, in the next week or two, hopefully, but that's still at their discretion, and we have not seen the final form as yet, although we had a lot of dialogue with them about what that would look like, and our expectation is it will be much like we planned. Beyond that, we had a meeting just last week with our coalition to sort of explore what options we have at implementation, and our broad thought is to have some pilot programs in some various markets so we have a little bit more understanding of who the persons involved are, what the understandings are, what the education would look like, and somewhat work those details out as we go before we take it statewide with maybe the best or not the best way to go at it. So that's our intent of trying to do it and then get about educating through the various stakeholder groups, the EMS folks, the nursing homes, physicians, nurses, nursing homes, all the individuals that would be involved with this so they can nuance their training around their specific needs.
Sure. And what's involved in implementation? I understand that Bloomington and Fort Wayne might be two cities that are used for pilots, and I'm not sure if that's accurate. Dr. Hickman, you look...
Yeah, so the form, I do want to clarify, the form will be available statewide. So effective July 1st, the law takes effect, and it is something that actually may be implemented in many parts of the state. There are sort of critical mass of individuals within both the Fort Wayne and the Bloomington areas who are really interested in implementing this in a very thoughtful manner and have the development or the beginnings of a group of people from many of the key organizations and institutions in the community at the table so they can start working out how to collaborate on this. It is a piece of paper. It's a form. But at the same time, in order for it to work, it requires collaboration across systems. So the Indiana Patient Preferences Coalition, which Dr. Walthall and I co-chair, has been talking about this issue for some time, and we are providing really intensive, we hope, support to those groups, but also through our coalition members are working on implementation within their respective memberships and stakeholders. We have 75 members for the coalition. Each of those members represents a large organization, institution, stakeholder group, and they have access to all of their contacts. So we do envision implementation both at the statewide level through those individuals, through those organizations, as well as with the more focused efforts in Fort Wayne and Bloomington. There also will be some work done in the Indianapolis area as well.
Now, from the patient's perspective, is this something that they would fill out online? Would they print it off? Would they do this with their doctors? What would that experience be like?
Well, it is a physician order, so it entails to be validated. It has to be signed by a physician. And the statute addresses the definitions of a qualified person, the terms under which it would operate, how it's actuated, who would have signatory efforts and all that. Various folks can have the conversations with patients around these parameters to begin to flesh out what their wishes would look like. But in the end of that, then that has to then be addressed with their physician and validated by a signature. So even though a person could get the form, they cannot act upon that until they have a physician's involvement.
Today on No Limits, we're talking about end-of-life issues. You can join the conversation by emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, connecting on Facebook or Twitter at No Limits, or calling 866-476-3881. We're here with Dr. Tim Brown. Dr. Susan Hickman and Dr. Jerry Walthall. Please stay with us. Back to No Limits. I'm Eric Bradner, Statehouse Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, and today we're talking about end-of-life issues with State Representative and Dr. Tim Brown, with Dr. Susan Hickman, a psychologist at the IU School of Nursing, and Dr. Jerry Walthall with Franciscan St. Francis Health. And we're talking about the POST program, which is a new state effort to get people thinking through some end-of-life issues ahead of time. Dr. Brown, I wondered if you could explain a little bit about what's actually on this form, what people are going to be prompted to work through ahead of time.
I'll turn that over to Dr. Walthall a little bit as a clinician working more. But it does talk about, you know, things that we hear about on TV, resuscitation, which is CPR, and intubation. But I'll let him go through the form just a little bit more.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. The premise of this is it addresses several parameters around patient preferences, and the one is the resuscitate or do not resuscitate aspect. And to some extent, that is much like our out-of-hospital DNR statute that we currently have. But in addition to that, beyond just addressing what your code status would be or your resuscitation preference, the second section addresses actual medical interventions that you may or may want delivered upon. And I would preface all of this by saying this is not for everyone. This is not for the healthy 20-year-old who just wants to state their opinion. This is for someone who has confronted a specific life-limiting illness that may have a year or less of time to endure that, and that they have now very specific considerations of their treatment and what it would look like. And so with that parameter in place, they would then decide if they want full intervention, all types of treatments that are available, no matter what the benefit or burden might be, or whether they would want only comfort measures only, or whether they would want something in between. And the intent of all this is that it's all predicated on a very thoughtful discussion with their family and their physician, their spiritual leaders, whoever, around who they are and what their choices would be, and then to make those kinds of preference decisions based on that. Beyond that, there's a section on antibiotic choices as to whether that's beneficial or not to them, and artificial nutrition hydration, which is much like what is on our current living will document. And then it has a section for documentation around signatures and who discussed what when, and then their instructions on the back. But that's the major portion of it.
If you make a decision on this, can you go back and change it at some point? Is there a way of, once you get down the line with, when you're talking with your family, with your doctor, do you envision people changing their minds?
Yes, it allows for it. This is perfectly voluntary. There is no requirement that anyone do this, and there's no pressure to be applied that they do it one way or the other. It's purely their consideration and their statement of preference. There is the opportunity to change that as they go forward, either go up or down that scale of intensity of care. They may decide later, you know, I've thought about this, and I really do want to do something more than I thought, so let's avoid this old one and do a new one. Or, gee, I thought I wanted all this treatment, but now I'm enduring things I really am not happy with, and I'd like to go now the more comfort measures. So anytime that occurs, that would be a preference for them to make and request a discussion with their healthcare provider or physician and tear that old one up and destroy it and make out a new one.
We have an email question, and it's perhaps a bit politically charged, but Kenny emails, Obamacare already enables and encourages end-of-life protocols. This was called death panels by right-wingers. So what is the significance of the bill other than to refuse to honor the value of the Affordable Care Act? Obviously a political question, but it does raise an issue. What does the Affordable Care Act deal with? What does this deal with that it doesn't touch on, that sort of thing?
Well, the Affordable Care Act at the federal level mainly dealt with financing. And so it talked about the financing issues related to Medicare and some other insurances as were spread out. Specifically, it talked about the Independent Practice Advisory Board, which will start to make financial restrictions and goals as they go along related to the Medicare program. It also talks about competitive research competitive effectiveness research, which will look at different treatments. And again, they're looking at cost effectiveness. So again, it's more financial driven, the language in the federal healthcare law. This law is patient driven, so the patient will be specifying what they want. So I feel they're two very different things. And just to piggyback on what Dr. Walthall saw, you know, part of the issue is we have seen, and Dr. Hickman kind of alluded to it, when somebody is at the end of life for, you know, heart failure, for cancer, for kidney failure, dementia or diseases related to the brain, but when something changes that the family's unexpected, breathing, maybe bleeding episode, a sore, or something like that, they don't like to see their loved one suffer. So they think of the only avenue they can do. They call 911. And right now, 911, and once you get into that system, the present forms that you fill out are meaningless. And so if you've had this conversation with your provider and your family, and everybody understands, so many times they end up in the emergency room and, oh, we didn't want that done. And you're like, okay, but we're there. And so this is patient-focused, patient-driven.
We have another email question from Bob. And Bob asks, and Dr. Hickman, perhaps this is one you could field, what's the difference between what is being discussed and an advanced directive? An advanced directive sounds like the post law. What's the difference?
That's a great question. There's several key differences. The first key difference is that the advanced directive statutes are designed to allow any adult to document their preferences at the end of life. That person may be perfectly healthy. Their end of life may be 50 years away. It's a very abstract consideration. And the advanced directives are designed to allow people to make those decisions well in advance of when any actual decisions when the real situation occurs. So that's one key difference. The post, in contrast, is designed for people who, you know, have a limited life expectancy due to advanced disease. It's specifically designed for people with advanced chronic progressive illness, advanced chronic progressive frailty. Frailty is a medical condition, not just a temporary issue when you've been under the weather with the flu. Or for people who have a condition from an injury, illness, or disease that is likely to will actually result in death without the use of life-prolonging procedures. So the post is a much narrower population versus an advanced directive, which is the general population. Additionally, another key difference is that the post is a medical order. It's physician orders for scope of treatment. It's signed as a physician order so that it can be honored throughout the healthcare system. And in contrast, a living will, which is a type of advance directive, requires interpretation by the physician and translation into the healthcare language in order for it to be used. Post is written by and for clinicians to communicate with each other, to translate that patient's preferences, their values and goals into medical language that healthcare professionals can follow and honor.
In terms of the practical aspect of doing that, Bob has a follow-up question. He says, whether advanced directive or post, in an emergency situation, a person may not have their end-of-life information with them. How will caregivers know what to do, know how to access this information?
The post form actually is designed to accompany the patient wherever they are at. So if a person resides at home, we've had some preliminary conversations with folks from EMS, and they have advised that they would like to see that form kept either with that patient's medications. Remember, these are people who already are sick, and they're going to have a pile of medicines on the counter or in the bathroom, or on the refrigerator. And in the healthcare setting, you'll see this in the medical record of the patient. The original copy of it is actually the property of the patient, but it is designed to go with them wherever they go throughout the healthcare system. So there is training and education around how do you make sure that form goes with them, and we anticipate and are prepared to address that. But that is true that could be an issue. So somebody who had a post form would be advised that they keep that with them if they're traveling around the state, that they make sure that that is part of the package of things they bring when they pack up their medicines and medical equipment, et cetera.
With more electronic medical records, is this something that could be folded into that? Is this something that, that doctors could perhaps access online or through the systems they might have?
I think in the future, absolutely. We're still not at a point where we have universal electronic medical records, and particularly in the settings where this is used, primarily the long-term care setting and the hospice setting, which is really the home setting, you know, that becomes less of a that's less useful. Many long-term care facilities still do not have electronic medical records. Certainly patients who are at home, that's not feasible. But I think down the road, that's something that would be definitely worth considering and evaluating. And there are states that have created electronic registries. But those states that have done that are all states who have many, many years of experience with this program. And it's generally not recommended it be the first step for any state.
We're talking about end-of-life decisions today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, connecting on Facebook or Twitter at No Limits, or calling 866-476-3881. Now, these decisions that, that people have to make at this stage are excruciating for the individuals, for their families. And Dr. Walthall, you've been with people when they've worked through these issues. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of pressure that it puts on families and why, broadly speaking, it's worth having taking the time to deliberately work through these types of things beforehand rather than trying to decide them in the moment and with a lot of emotions sort of flowing?
Absolutely, and that is the crux of the matter. It's the human condition that we all acknowledge that from birth on that we do have an expiration date, and we don't want to particularly deal with that, and hopefully it's way out in the future after a long, productive life. But it will come to all of us, and none of us have a particular desire to be dead or to have a loved one be dead. And because of that dilemma, we all struggle with it, you know, whether this is the day or not, or should it happen, or, you know, what it might. It isn't, the discussion is not about if you will be dead. It's about how you want to live until that happens. And we do have choices to make around that in all sorts of things throughout our life, but particularly at our end of life where we're declining, those things become much more pointed and focused. And it's critical that folks begin to embrace that notion that the day will come. It's not something that they should avoid discussing, but in fact, candidly sit down with their family and loved ones and spiritual advisors and have a conversation about who am I and what am I about, and if the what-ifs in life happen, what might my response be to that, and begin to craft some thinking around that so folks have a cultural understanding of who this person is and what we'd speak to. The critical part of all this is to have that conversation and to appoint a healthcare representative who has the courage, knowledge, and wisdom to make those decisions for you, because the day often comes when you may not be able to make those decisions yourself, and it could be today if the truck hits you on the way home. So it's not necessarily just old folks, but all of us need to take more ownership, I think, of our responsibilities for living and planning for the eventualities in life, just like we buy life insurance or anything else. So I think those are critical, but it's much more relieved and doable if someone comes in with a clear understanding, a clear preference of their own wishes and desires. For the healthcare professional physicians, it's much easier to have that conversation with the loved ones and family and say, you know, this isn't a burden on your shoulders. Mother has made this choice. She's put this clearly in front of us. I understand that. I'm sad to tell you, but this is the time she talked about. We've reached that. and we all need to now rally together and honor her dignity and who she is. That's a much more comforting discussion than, gee, shouldn't you do everything, and I'm going to sue you if you don't, and all this kind of stuff that goes on with everybody with unresolved grief and agony and anger and all sorts of things about this. It's never an easy thing to lose a loved one, but it can be made much more comforting to do it in ways that are respectful.
When we talk about the POST program, it's within the context of end-of-life care that's sort of foreseeable, right? This is for people who are already ill. What about the scenario that Dr. Walthall just raised? Someone is hit by a truck, right? Something unforeseen happens. What should younger people do? What should healthy people do to sort of deal with the reality that they could get very unlucky one day? What types of conversations are worth having, even without the context of working through this POST form? And I'll throw that to any of you who want to feel.
Go ahead, Doctor.
We could probably all share on this, but the questioner that just wrote in earlier about advance directive is just an umbrella term that applies to any sort of a declaration a person would make about health care in advance. And we have all sorts of statutes on the book, living will being one, healthcare representative another, out-of-hospital DNR. There's a whole list of them that are statutorily covered. And what I would say is for the young, healthy person, for everyone above 18 years of age, they should designate a healthcare representative. They should decide who could and would have the courage and insight to speak for me. And it may or may not be your closest friend or your relative even. It may be somebody that's, you know, known to you that has that affinity and the willingness to do it. But then to have that conversation, engage with that person, and then put that in writing as a healthcare representative designee. And if need, if you wish, fill out a living will as well, because those are all advance directives that are appropriate for any age person who has a particular mindset about what things they may or may not want done if the worst what if happens to them. So all those things I think are appropriate to do, but again, it's this conversation that takes place, and it's a living, dynamic conversation. It changes from the 18-year-old to the 40-year-old with four kids to the person that's had the big heart attack to the person that now has end-stage cancer. Those are different dynamics and different discussions, and there are different understandings and documents to support those person's decisions.
Sure.
I think Dr. Walthall put it very well as far as, you know, the POST form is just a specific entity for end-of-life care that's physician-ordered, and all these other forms, we didn't repeal any of them. They're still there and still widely available and should be used. And part of the problem is why we have some of the conversation opposed is people haven't had these discussions before.
Yeah, some people, especially younger, healthy people, might not have relationships with doctors, might not go in for regular checkups. Is there something they ought to be doing to try to get these decisions, these conversations on the record or documented legally?
The Indiana Advance Directives are available online. They're available for downloading for free. You do not need to pay money for them. Any healthcare institution you set foot in will have copies of them available. So I encourage people to go ahead and download that and start reading through and thinking about what it means. What does it mean to identify someone to speak on your behalf? Who would you want to do that? Who do you think could best represent your values and goals and who you are as a person? And then in concert with that, if you have someone in mind, to talk with them about that. Don't just put their name down and file it away in a box, but have a have multiple conversations, hopefully, with that person. And sometimes there are natural points in life where these conversations occur. You may have a family member or a friend who's very ill or who dies, and that is really a good opportunity to have this kind of conversation, to reflect about what's meaningful to you and what you want, what gives life meaning to you, what's important to you, ultimately are your goals and hopes and aspirations, and if something unforeseen happened, what would you want to occur? So I think looking for those opportunities to engage in conversation, sometimes it's something as simple as a television show. You're watching Grey's Anatomy. There are lots of opportunities if you start paying attention. Be mindful that the portrayals on Grey's Anatomy and shows like that are not always accurate, but there are lots of opportunities to have those conversations.
We're talking about end-of-life issues today on No Limits. You can join the conversation by emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, connecting via Facebook or Twitter, and No Limits, or calling 866-476-3881. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm Eric Bradner, State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press, and today we're talking about end-of-life issues. Our guests are Dr. Susan Hickman, a psychologist with the IU School of Nursing, Jerry Wolfhall with Franciscan St. Francis Health, and Tim Brown, who is also a state representative from Crawfordsville and the chairman of the Indiana House Ways and Means Committee. We've been talking about the post law, and this is only one part of the advanced care planning process. And Dr. Hickman, I wondered if you could run us through sort of the broader picture of what all that entails.
Sure. So advanced care planning is really a term that encompasses a broad range of activities, including conversations, documentation. And the goal behind advanced care planning is to start encouraging people to think about preferences and values really from early adulthood on. In the healthcare setting, advanced care planning is often discussed in the context of people who have a diagnosis, a new diagnosis of a disease that we know is chronic, that we know is progressive, and to start encouraging people to begin thinking about their preferences, to begin thinking about what's important to them, and having those conversations with families and family members and friends as well. The advanced care planning model really promotes multiple conversations rather than one conversation where you sign a form, stick it in a file, and check that box on your list of to-dos. It's really about a process of multiple conversations over time. As Dr. Walthall suggested, people's values, preferences, goals really do shift depending on what's happening, and particularly as we get older, different considerations come into play. So POST fits into the advanced care planning process as one advanced care planning tool, but it is one of just many tools. At the same time, it is a tool that's incredibly valuable for that specific population of people who are nearing the end of life, because it allows them to further specify their preferences to either have or decline interventions. So it allows us to really provide truly patient-centered care that is tailored to that individual.
Sure. Now, we have a call from Robert. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's your question?
Well, I'm an intensivist and chairman of medical ethics at one of the other hospitals in town. And we were just discussing the post law this morning, and we came across a potential problem with it. And that is that if a patient is incapacitated, their healthcare representative or healthcare power of attorney can void their previous post. And we may have a situation where a patient has decided they don't want resuscitative efforts, they don't want mechanical ventilation, they don't want dialysis, et cetera, and then they become incapacitated, and their healthcare representative comes in and says, I'm not going to honor the patient's wishes, even though I'm supposed to act as that patient's agent and follow their wishes. I'm not going to honor that, and I'm going to void the post. And you're going to do everything within the medical armamentarium for this patient, even though it isn't going to help.
Okay. Robert, thank you for raising the issue. Dr. Hickman, you look eager to jump in.
Not about eager, but I do think that's a valid question and concern. The law also specifically states that the responsibility of that healthcare representative is to act in a way that's consistent with that patient's preferences. So the law actually requires that they act in a way that follows through on the patient's preferences. The bigger picture question is, what do you do about these families that are dysfunctional? And I would argue in this situation, that patient should probably have picked a different healthcare representative. That person is probably not the right person to represent their preferences. The operative word in that term is representative. They're supposed to be representing that patient. And I think one of the things that we can do as healthcare providers is in advance really counsel people to be thoughtful about who they elect to speak on their behalf. Is it somebody who feels comfortable honoring that person's preferences, even if they don't match the choices they'd make for themselves? Those are important considerations in identifying who will be allowed to speak for you in the event that you cannot speak for yourself.
I think you raise a very good point there, that they're the representative, because I think it'll start to have conversations about realistic treatment also. Mm-hmm. As a provider, you may have had that conversation with a patient, and the patient understands, but the family doesn't. And they may look at the Grey's Anatomy shows or the different shows and think, I have unrealistic expectation of what may happen to my loved one, and therefore I'm going to void the form. Where hopefully those conversations will start to occur and the information will disseminate that the unrealistic expectations cannot be met.
That's the second time Grey's Anatomy has come up.
Yeah.
And one of the problems with a show like that is that the outcomes they get are not realistic, right? They seem to succeed far more often than doctors really can. I think statistically, those shows don't really represent what goes on in hospitals. And Dr. Hickman, you're nodding your head. But does popular culture, does media sort of give people expectations that are unrealistic, or perhaps changes the way they think of these things?
Unfortunately, yes. There was a really interesting study many years ago that looked at the portrayals of cardiopulmonary resuscitation on the television show ER. And what they found was that it, based on what they portrayed on TV, people were successfully resuscitated and walking out of the hospital healthy and happy 75% of the time. And the reality is, in patients in the hospital setting who have who stop breathing and their heart stops and go into cardiopulmonary arrest, resuscitation is effective 17% of the time in that population. When you move out into the community setting, particularly the long-term care setting, you see rates of success of about 3%. And that's, you know, do they even survive to make it to the hospital? Not do they survive to discharge from the hospital? And, you know, if they do survive, what condition are they in? So we see a real challenge in the way in which healthcare is portrayed as sort of being able to rescue people in all circumstances, when in reality, people with advanced chronic progressive illness have a disease that we cannot cure, and they ultimately will stop breathing and their heart will stop, and the likelihood that we can do anything to reverse that is very small. And I think, unfortunately, we're often fighting against that unrealistic expectation.
We have a couple of emails that I want to get to quickly. One listener has a sort of a futuristic question. Is there a way that, given the post law, some of these preferences can be perhaps microchipped into someone?
Not at this time.
It is a future state, and if not so future, perhaps. I mean, there have been some folks exploring apps on cell phones, chips, all sorts of things. It's certainly above my wisdom and understanding know how that would work. It gets into also HIPAA issues and privacy and all sorts of other things. But no question, someday I'm sure we will have access to that sort of thing more as a real-time opportunity. But to date, I'm not aware of anything that's really on the drawing board that looks like it's usable today for us.
And I think one of the things maybe for the future is a lot of people are looking at your medical record on the cloud, so you can download it wherever you go. So I don't know if this is a form that you'll be able to scan in and download to the cloud. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, if I'm up in South Bend, even though I'm a patient of a system here in the central Indiana area, you know, I could download it for a South Bend institution.
And that's mm-hmm. much closer at hand than a microchip. Okay. And I do know there are efforts. There's a team out in California working on a digital pulse that does exactly what Dr. Brown describes. But we're still a little ways away before we could actually implement something like that on a broad-based basis, but I think that is not far off in the future.
You know, I think one of the, maybe as an aside to this, I think I would advocate that everybody should try to collect their own medical information and keep it for themselves. I mean, you know, I guess as a healthcare provider, I've done that, because whenever I go to a different provider, I carry my folder with me, so mm-hmm. things don't have to be repeated over and over and over.
And that's a very critical point. You can't have too many people aware of your personhood and what you want represented for you. And so certainly share it with all your family members. Don't keep it exclusive to your healthcare representative. Tell them, they may disagree, but tell them that's fine, I understand, but at the end of the game, this person will make the decisions for these reasons. And that dissuades folks from a lot of angst and anger sometimes that gets played out in the emergency room waiting room. In addition to that, I think you can't have the paper documents they are today. You should have one in your own person's hands, in your healthcare representative, in your family physician's hands, any hospital that you frequent or have been to before. And some, I've heard some attorneys in estate planning and all even advocate having one in your purse, in your glove compartment, anywhere that would be accessible. Because if we can't see it, we don't know it exists, and we can't act on it until we can validate it. So.
Sure. And Dr. Brenner, are there further public policy steps that need to be taken in this realm? Is there something that's next for perhaps the state legislature or the State Department of Health, or is this something that people need to sort of think about on their own and with their doctors and need to look to some technology, the cloud that you all were just sort of explaining? What's next?
Well, I think as far as electronic medical record, it is a cost item for a provider to try and access and interact with each other. You know, we were just talking before the show that, you know, we basically represent different hospital systems, and those systems really don't talk to each other electronically. So long term, we're going to have a platform that talks electronically to each other, and that's going to take money for the infrastructure, the hardware.
We have another email question, and the listener wants to know the thoughts of each of you on proposed changes to the organ donation system that could give hospital officials more authority to set their own rules for patient contacts and decisions. I'm frankly not aware of those proposed changes, so Dr. Brown, if you could explain them, first of all, that'd be a good place to start.
Well, I think what they're trying to get at is, can you make the organ procurement and donation system a little bit more individualized by institution and maybe a clinical setting? And I think one of the great things we have in a system-wide application of organ donation is you try to get it should, and maybe it doesn't happen all the time, but you get it to the sickest person at the right time with the right need. So to do an individualized system, I think, would delve away from that and would not be beneficial to all the citizens.
Sure. Any other thoughts on that issue?
I don't. That's my understanding as well, and it's a very slippery slope when you get into individualizing those types of things, and it would have to have a lot of thought and insight, I think.
Sure. Let's get back to where we started with the POST program. We talked a little bit about implementation and how this is a process. I wondered if you could explain what implementation means, what parts of this. I mean, people hear us talking about a form. Sounds like a form comes with instructions, and then you would just act on that. What is there to implement? What is there to test and experience and that sort of thing?
There are multiple considerations. So the POST is itself a form, but it also relies on collaboration across multiple institutions. It requires that the hospitals know what it is when somebody shows up in the emergency department with the form. It requires that EMS recognize it and understand that they're required to honor it. It requires that the individuals who are working with patients in completing these forms understand what it is, what the parameters are. It requires that patients and families understand what it can and can't do, when it's when it will, you know, basically kick into action. So all of those pieces need to fit together. It really won't work if there's one really enthusiastic physician in one community and nobody else in the community has a clue what it is. So it requires education at multiple levels and coordination and collaboration among those different players who interface in the healthcare system to help ensure that we can indeed honor the preferences that are documented on the POST form in a consistent and reliable manner.
And all the various healthcare providers have their own approach to policies and procedures, and they do have to have a verifiable process for receiving, interpreting, placing in the chart, those sorts of things. So, and they're all variable somewhat depending on the practice that they have and the institution's own policies and values and whatever. So it does make sure, it requires that we get all those things on the table and have some collaboration around making sure those are a smooth transition and not having barriers put in place because of individual variations in places.
And you know, just think, July 1st, the average practitioner and the average institution isn't going to change how they give care because, you know, they have processes in place and, you know, you write the prescriptions based on what you see or you do the care based on what you do. So it's going to have to be an incorporation process as change the way of thinking after July 1st.
And Dr. Brown, how much of Indiana's post-form is being developed on the state level versus how much is sort of adopted from other states? How much of this is uniform across the, I think Dr. Hickman said 16 states?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I the State Department of Health was in charge of that, and I know the coalition has been instrumental in giving information. We at one time talked about should we dictate what the form looked like in law, and the advisors who wrote the law said that's not a good idea. So we didn't go down that avenue. But I think the coalition feels very happy about they were able to have input to the State Department of Health.
Yeah, I will say that this is based on a national model, and it does. There are several core elements to the form and the program overall that are shared across all the states that have similar programs. But there are some things about this that are unique to Indiana, some things that we did that other states opt not to do. So we have a required patient or representative signature on the form. Not every state requires the patient or the representative signature. That is one difference. We have some restrictions in who could complete this form on behalf of someone who lacks decisional capacity. It has to be someone who's been legally appointed, either as a healthcare representative, a guardian, or a healthcare power of attorney, or a parent if it's a minor. And that is not true in other states. There are other states that have other, their laws are a little different, so they allow what we call a default surrogate to make those decisions on behalf of the patient. So we have some differences definitely in how this was constructed that really represent the thoughtful and really intense process the coalition went through in developing the Indiana program. So this really is tailored to this state in meeting the needs and concerns of the broader community.
Okay. And it is a medical order. I think you all said that. And really quickly, can you explain what that means?
Well, it's an order that is actually written by a physician, just like a physician would write an order for an antibiotic or a pain medication. And it has the advanced directives otherwise, the living wills and all, are a statement of a patient's preferences, but they're predicated by the statement at the top that if in the opinion of my physician, I meet these criteria. And if the physician does not think you meet that criteria, then that is not operational. This document, once it is filled out, is an operational document, particularly in the ambulance setting or the nursing home or the home and that sort of thing, where there's no other health care providers available to make those sort of critical thinking judgments.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. We've been talking about end-of-life decisions today on No Limits with Drs. Susan Hickman, Jerry Walthall, and Tim Brown. I'm Eric Bradner, State House Bureau Chief for the Evansville Courier and Press. Thanks for listening.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.